I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we'll be having the conversation we'd planned with our bibliophiles very shortly. They'll be recommending good mysteries. But after what happened in Pittsburgh this weekend, we thought it might be important to hear from some trusted voices in our community about what an attack on a synagogue means for us, people living in another city, trying to reconcile the dangers that exist around identity in America today, particularly in the Jewish community, but by no means exclusively in the Jewish community. We've invited Marvin Schneller to share some perspective. He recently retired as the director of the Jewish Community Relations Bureau American Jewish Committee. They do a lot of work around understanding anti-Semitism and hate and trying to dismantle it. Marvin, hello.
Hi.
We're also joined by Rabbi Mark Levin, founding rabbi of Congregation Beth Torah. He's been active in the social justice community for a long time. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
So I want to start by asking you what you're hearing from people in Kansas City over the last day or two.
I'm hearing from both Jews and folks who are not Jewish. Actually, primarily, I'm hearing from people who are not Jewish with their condolences. Quite a large number of clergy have responded. From the Jewish community, I'm hearing people say pretty much that, A, they're worried. Some are frightened.
The nature of the fear. Can you elaborate on what the fear is from here?
Well, the point I was getting to exactly is that people understand that there's anti-Semitism. And, of course, we had the murders here just a few years ago. So it's very much on people's minds. But now to have it brought up as a clear and present danger in a synagogue, it simply brings home once again this terrible fear that when you're in the act of doing something religious, you could be murdered by an extremist.
You know, I want to bring up something that just, I think, kind of goes through my mind, and I'm not sure how helpfully it goes through my mind, is that if you've been raised on stories from Holocaust survivors, you hear about that the people who got out are the people who recognized that something was really bad first, the people who saw the writing on the wall first. And so I think there is this sort of internalized training to say, has it gotten that bad now?
Yes, this is very much on people's minds. And what you bring up is very pertinent because I, of course, have known many people, and Marvin should speak to this as the son of a Holocaust survivor. But, of course, I knew many people who left between 1932 and 1940, and that's a long stretch. The people who left in 1940 clearly understood what was coming. But I have a new perspective on people who left in 32 or 33. How did they know what was going to happen 3, 4, 5 years later? And an enormous amount of respect for them recognizing the clear and present danger that was not so obvious to everyone and the efforts that they had to undertake to save their lives and to save their families' lives, which, of course, in the end, meant that they survived and the communities that they left did not.
Marvin, jump in here.
I agree with Rabbi Levin on everything he has said. And I do want to echo that I've heard from many, many non-Jews, Muslim, Christian, Catholic, everybody, African Americans, etc. The fear amongst people today, I believe, is amongst almost everyone, regardless of your religious affiliation or your skin color. The virtually everyone feels like they're a target. You know, I'm sad that this week two African Americans were killed in a Kroger's. It barely got any news coverage. And if you read the story, this person knocked on the door, tried to get into a church where there were a dozen people, gun in hand, for a massive tragedy.
A predominantly black church.
Right? Yes, and couldn't get in, walked past a white person, and then murdered two African Americans. We should all regrettably be in fear. I look to Rabbi Levin for his wisdom on these kinds of things. My parents could not get out of Europe, did not have the means, and that's a very frightful today there's so much in so many parts of the world, but today in Kansas City we have every reason to be fearful of what could happen.
I'm surprised in some ways to hear you saying that, only not because the news doesn't make me feel that way too, but because you are someone who I consider to be this voice of, like, you know, he'll have some, you know, if you get an anti-Semitic email, you know, you're the guy people forward it to, like, but should I really be worried here? And what are the, like, basic practical steps I need to take? You're that guy.
Yes. However, I feel people have become empowered over the last 2 years that they can take action. We used to joke and say, you got mail from Nazis or KKK folks. They just like to talk and spew horrible stuff. Those folks, I'm afraid, feel empowered today to pick up a gun and walk in anywhere they want, whether it's the mall, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a parking lot. We should all be fearful.
So two things have changed, building on what Marvin just said. And again, totally in agreement with him. But I think two things have changed. Being a public figure, I, for 40 years now, four decades, when I put something out in public, would get letters, telephone calls. One guy came to my door one time to tell me how angry he was with me and encountered not me, but my family. And as Marvin said, we always discounted that. What's changed is two things, in my opinion. One is othering that comes from the very top of the nation's political structure, where now we have politicians who are, what should one say, normalizing, rationalizing, identifying other groups as the enemy. So there's two things there. One is identifying a group, and secondly, saying that those people are worthy of being hated. The third thing that occurs, and this was in an article over the weekend in Forbes magazine by a psychologist named Todd Essig, that when you identify those people and you say that they're worthy of being hated, and then you advocate violence, you are giving permission to people who are on the extreme and who have access to guns, as that's the second thing that has changed, to go ahead and act on that violence with impunity, knowing that you have a community of support that will back what you've done and even consider you to be a hero. So those two things, I believe, have changed. One is the popular community of support that says hating is a good thing. And secondly, the public othering of other people by officials who are supposedly opinion makers and leaders of a democracy, who are identifying internally to the United States people who are worthy of being hated.
So it sounds like you see this problem at least in part stemming from the political climate. Is the solution something that comes from politics, or does it require either something else more in addition?
So let me be clear about this. And Abe Foxman, the past head of the Anti-Defamation League, came out this morning and said, don't blame President Trump. Whereas the psychologist 100% said, blame President Trump. I'm a person who says, listen, every additional feather to the back of the camel may, in fact, break the camel's back. So one doesn't know where all the change is coming from. But clearly, part of the change is coming from the political structure. If those people involved in politics, and I include my congressman in the 3rd District in Kansas, whom I asked to be public about decrying anti-Semitism and saying that anti-Semitism was unacceptable in the United States, and I got no response. And that needs to be done in the political structure. People need to stand up and say, this is totally unacceptable, and we will declare that everyone who lives here is welcome here, and we are all equally responsible for one another. Can that make a difference? I absolutely believe that it can. I'm very heartened by the number of responses that I've gotten from people. People walk up to me on the street. Every place that I go to, I say, I'm awfully sorry. Well, nothing happened in my family. So what are they saying? They're saying, we recognize the fact that you are being targeted, and we are so sorry about it. And that is welcome, particularly from the people who are opinion makers.
Marvin, jump in.
My first call on Saturday morning, soon after I learned this, was from my friend Mohammed Chaudhry, who's at Hallmark, calling with condolences. And my first response was, Mohammed, I've been more fearful for you than for me. But my world changed on Saturday. I really, despite Jews being targeted but not murdered in the parking lot in which I worked and the nursing home in which my mother lived, it didn't hit home. It has hit home, and I am afraid today. I do want to add to what the rabbi said about elections, which is hugely important. But every single one of us has to speak up, and it may take a little bit of bravery. I was at an event recently, and I sat next to a very, let's say, sophisticated person who's performed for the symphony for many years. And in the course of the conversation, he said, I met this great artist, African-American artist I knew, and they said, introduce myself. And I said, hey, not bad for a black guy. I said, what are you saying? How can you say that? You're going to say not bad for a Jewish guy for me? We have to just speak up. Those comments cannot go unchecked. They cannot be appear to be acceptable in our society, particularly in the environment that the rabbi described. It's coming from all corners, and the people who are trying to speak rationality are being delegitimized. And it's really up to every single person, and they can make a difference. They gotta stop. It's not just elected officials. The person with the shopping cart behind me at Price Chopper cannot get away with spewing hatred.
No, it's absolutely the case. And one of the things that's occurring, it sounds like a tag team here. We're absolutely 100% in agreement. And one of the things that's occurring is this meme language that indicates to people who the hated groups are. So thug means a member of the African-American community. And immigrants clearly are Hispanics, or gangs are clearly Hispanics. And
so the pairing of a slur with references to a specific group, over time, it becomes code.
It becomes code language. And George Soros has become the code for some international Jewish cabal that is running the world, which is absolutely ridiculous, but comes out of a forgery called the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which still, this forgery is still being published and read by people. It's absolute nonsense. But the president of the United States is identifying George Soros, and people are reading that on a certain part of the political spectrum as, he's the leader of the cabal that is controlling the world. This kind of language must stop. And the only way I think that it really, or the best way for it to stop, is if everyone says, this is not acceptable. This is just not acceptable language.
You know, I want to bring up sort of this like 5-minute emotional odyssey I went on Saturday in the just brief time after I heard what had happened in Pittsburgh. I went from this immediate impulse to want to be surrounded by Jewish people because, you know, it's not that I was like afraid of everyone else or something. It was more because I didn't know if other people could understand what I was feeling. And then I kind of was frustrated with that thought and responded to myself with, you know, no, I don't want to live in a ghetto of my own creation. I believe in the goodness of my friends and neighbors every bit as much as I believe that there is real danger and real hatred out there. I can believe in both at the same time. But what that first feeling was about was not being sure that people who live without that feeling of a threat hanging over them could understand what supporting me means. Does that make sense? Can you
Yes.
help people out there know what supporting, I will go ahead and say us, means?
Yes, I think it is outreach. But I want to add to this. I'm not young. And for my entire life, having anti-Semitism aimed at me meant that I was different. And now I think it means it makes me the same. I think the hatred that is leveled at the African-American community, the Hispanic community, the immigrant community, other immigrants to the United States, I don't think this event is any different than the events that have been labeled, that have been leveled at others. And I think that's what's changed. So I think if you go to people and you say, listen, we are all together in this. If you go to a mosque and you say, I'm here because I want to learn about Islam, and I'm here because I'm a friend of yours, even if we don't know one another, that's the same as going to a synagogue and saying, listen, we support you. Because many people are being othered, new word, othered in this culture, and it is unacceptable and is ending up in enormous acts of hatred that were at one time buried and are now being legitimated and being brought to the fore.
I agree. It takes bravery for people to stand up. But boy, it has to be done on – it cannot hatred and bigotry just cannot go on. I've lived my life having on my office Pastor Niemöller's expression. First they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, and I didn't speak up. And then he goes through a few cases. They came for the Jews. I didn't speak up because I wasn't Jewish. They came for me, and there was no one left to speak up.
What is it about speaking up that requires bravery? That might sound like a silly question, but as someone who has done it, what is it in those moments that is scary, and how do you get past them?
Well, people, what you do to get past it is knowing you are right and knowing you're doing the right thing, knowing that you're not only protecting yourself, but you may very well be protecting someone else from being murdered or being bullied.
Do you think that our sort of what we understand as being polite is something that can get in the way? How do you get past that when that's really deeply ingrained? Like, you don't...
Sure. So, two things. One, in the face of evil, politeness is a luxury. We must get beyond somebody saying something bigoted and saying, well, he's my neighbor, or I don't want him to say anything. No. That is an unacceptable thought, and now we are seeing the results of not speaking out. And the other thing is, where did Americans come up with this idea that because you're afraid, you shouldn't act? We were never a fearful people. We are people who say, this is what is right, and therefore I'm going to act. And if it's a little bit threatening to me, or a lot threatening to me, makes no difference. It's right, so I do it. And we have put ourselves into ghettoized, even small communities that have to reinforce one another's fears. No, we are a human family, and we stand up for one another, and we say, listen, you just can't say this. And if it makes a little bit, if it brings a little bit of fear to me, so be it, because I'm doing what is right.
You know, we have just a little time left, and this might be a preposterous question, but where do you find comforts in moments like this?
My humanity and God.
And in the people who've reached out and understand. But, you know, in some ways, we have to be unselfish by speaking up. In the end, it's being selfish for our own protection. But I'm very troubled today by people who are my friends who say, you know, the economy's great. There are so many good things. I don't want to rock the boat. Boy, we got to rock the boat.
Marvin Schneller, Rabbi Mark Levin, thank you both so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Gina, for doing this.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Keep talking about this on Twitter. There are more conversations to be had. Let us know what you still struggle to understand in the aftermath of not just Pittsburgh, but other troubling moments in our culture. We're at KCURCST. In just a moment, the Bibliophiles will be joining us to talk books. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now the bibliophiles are here. We're talking this morning about mysteries, everything from Nancy Drew and whodunits. That's pretty much my speed, to the darker, more disturbing stuff you might need to read with all the lights on, all the lights in the whole entire house. The bibliophiles are Mark Luce, Katie Stover, and Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Hi, guys.
Hi. Good morning.
So mysteries. And, you know, part of the reason why we are talking about mysteries is because Katie Stover has a theory that prejudice against genre fiction is vanishing. Katie?
Well, it's becoming far more and more accepted. People are freely admitting that they read romance and mystery and science fiction and fantasy, and their librarians are on board with that. Like, yes, so are we. So we're certainly welcoming more readers to the reading fold, and people are getting a lot more comfortable talking about what they like in their genres.
So what is a mystery? That might sound totally dumb, but I really kind of struggled when I first sat down to actually prepare for this show, because it is not necessarily gory or violent. We're not talking about the thriller genre or horror. You know, Nancy Drew, Encyclopedia Brown, those are mysteries.
Yep, and Jeff wrote one.
So what is it?
A mystery is a puzzle. A mystery is a puzzle to be solved. And the puzzle can sometimes be stolen jewels or stolen government papers. It can also be a dead body. You know, and it's the attraction for the reader is solving the puzzle along with the detective in the book, the investigator in the book, because investigators are sometimes amateurs and sometimes professionals.
You know, something that I would consider a favorite, and I'm not sure if you would count it in this genre, is Harriet the Spy. And she doesn't know what the mystery is that she's solving, but she is identifying with the character of the spy and the character of the mystery solver. And she's discovering a lot of very joyful, happy, fascinating things that there is no quote-unquote crime is usually what she's discovering.
Harriet the Spy is a great example of another reason why people like to read mysteries. It's for the characters. It's not just the puzzle. It's the way the character is solving the puzzle. And Harriet the Spy is about getting to know Harriet and how her mind works and all these little puzzles she's solving about all these people that intrigue her. It's satisfying her curiosity. So there's no mystery to solve in Harriet the Spy, but we see as readers the creation of an investigator as we're reading, and we're fascinated with these characters, these people in Harriet's life, the way we are fascinated with Harriet and the way she is fascinated with them.
I'd like to pick up this idea of the collapsing brow. You know, when I first started reviewing books, there were highbrow books, midbrow books, lowbrow books. There was a huge prejudice against genre fiction, which were seen as lowbrow. And the brow has collapsed.
Now, I love that. The brow has collapsed, everyone.
I would say that a good book is a good book, you know.
So what makes a good mystery to you then?
Noticing pattern and coincidence and clues. Sleuthing.
What about, do you like sleuthy?
Yeah, sleuthy.
What about, I mean, Mark, your list does get a little into the darker side of things. And I'm wondering if there is something to talk about in the possible discomfort around reading and recommending books where an incident that it revolves around and even the tone of the writing is, you know, a thing you would not condone.
I would agree. I think what, for me, we just read Oedipus a few weeks ago with the sophomores at Barstow. And what I told them before we started was, this is the first detective story. And of course they look at you like, what are you talking about?
Imagine that someone has not read Oedipus. What do they need to know about it to understand what you mean?
Okay, so there's a scourge that plagues, Thebes. And Tiresias, a blind prophet, comes and says, hey, you need to find out who murdered your former leader. And once you find that out and exile that person, then the plague will go away. And so Oedipus sets out to find the killer.
And so this
and
is
I'm
from
not gonna
ancient
give,
Greece.
I'm not going to spoil
right.
it.
No, this is from ancient Greece, and it's usually shelved among classics. Would be the genre for that.
Sure.
But you are telling people this is the first detective story.
He has to find out who the murderer was. He brings in any number of people. He brings in a shepherd. He brings in a messenger. He brings in a soothsayer. He brings in his brother-in-law. He brings in his wife. And he questions all of these people. And eventually, the truth outs.
Yeah. And boy, is it a
good one. Yeah.
It's one you
won't forget. And so for me, when I look at these, you know, like your Hammetts and your Chandlers, like seeing that detective kind of go about walking these sort of boundaries of kind of good and bad, where maybe the detective's not quite as good as he thinks that he or she is.
You know, we're going to get into your all's recommendations very shortly, but I do also want to add that a lot of mysteries come in series, and KCUR's own David Folk, when I reached out to staff for their recommendation, he just recommended series, period. And here's what he says. I'm going to make a pitch for the mystery series. I think people read these more than the one-offs. It's great fun getting caught up in the characters as they develop and the places where the stories are set. The ones I read faithfully are Three Pines series by Louise Penny featuring Armand Gamache, please forgive if that's not correct in pronunciation, Ann Perry's Thomas and Charlotte Pitt series, and Jacqueline Winspear's Maisie Dobbs series. If I do read a one-off, it's most likely because of the setting or time period. Is setting and time period and character? It seems like these are the reasons that he likes the series. And then when one book is over, he can re-immerse himself in that world.
Notice he didn't mention the puzzle or the dead body. He mentioned the characters and the time period and the setting. Those are very important to a series mystery. And that's what series mystery authors focus on more than anything else. A lot of authors will try to step away from their characters, and that's why sometimes they kill off their detectives, because they're tired of writing that and they're tired of coming up with a plot to drop their character in. But that's why readers keep going back to series. They enjoy spending time with these characters in this particular place. The Maisie Dobbs series by Jacqueline Winspear. Those are popular because of the time period she sets in for her detective, Maisie.
What time period is that?
It starts in World War I and it moves. I think right now Maisie's in 1920s because time is marching on with Maisie and the author's doing a great job moving Maisie through.
So this isn't The Simpsons where Bart is perpetually in fourth grade?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, there are other things that are surrounding Maisie's character. She is a World War I nurse and she suffers from PTSD. So these are also elements of the series that Winspear is addressing.
Okay, well, you can call in to recommend the mystery or novel series, mystery novel or mystery series you love, 816-235-2888. What was it really about to you? And it is acceptable to say it was about the crime and the whodunit, but if it's more, we'd like to hear about that. I'm curious. 816-235-2888. So, Jeffrey and Gowdy, let's start with a recommendation from you. I am really intrigued by Ways to Disappear.
Okay, Ways to Disappear. I'd like to just briefly, though, pay homage to Nancy Drew. I brought in one of the original little indigo covered books with Nancy as the black silhouette with her little magnifying glass. And I didn't want to reread it because I thought the attitudes would be really dated. But I love how resourceful she is. She hung out with what, in the parlance of the time, a tomboy named George. Her father was a distinguished lawyer. Her mother, there's no interfering mother getting in the way of all the freedom that she has. And her boyfriend, Ned Nickerson, I think is pretty much just like a fashion accessory. I mean, he doesn't get in the way of her pursuits. So it's really a good role model for me.
Aw. She's generally a good role model aside from, you know, the genre she represents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't want to go back and read the attitudes. This was published in the 30s. And actually, it has little pockets glued in here. It's my sister-in-law's book because she made a lending library. And then my daughter also had her friend sign in the lending library.
So that's so sweet.
Very nostalgic. Okay, Ways to Disappear is actually a very curious book to talk about. Idra Novi published it in 2016, and she's a translator. And so this book is a send-up of a lot of different genres. And It features a translator, and she has a beloved author, and she's translated four of her works. And the beloved author, Beatriz Yagoda, has disappeared in Brazil. She was last seen in an almond tree smoking a cigar. And, and it sounds very improbable, and the whole thing is very improbable, but beautifully written. So Emma is the translator, and she leaves snowy Pittsburgh and goes to sizzling Rio de Janeiro, and she's met by a loan shark. And it turns out that Beatriz has an online gambling addiction. It owes him $600,000. And he thinks that this translator for a small press, she's paid $500 a book, is going to cough up $600,000. Pretty soon she links up with the children, the very plodding daughter, improbably named Raquel, and the very dizzily handsome son, Marcus. And now we get pretty much a send-up of a lot of different genres. There are ransom notes. There's a severed ear. There's a gun. It does go off. But this is written in the most inventive and just beautifully poetic way. But it's also very funny. And there's lots of little inserts and dictionary definitions and wordplay. And she has a book coming out, I think, next month. But I would very much recommend this. This got great, great reviews when it came out. I reviewed it for the Star. And also got a couple of literary awards. So it's very stylish. Ways to Disappear by Idra Novi.
It's a really fascinating premise, the translator whose author has gone missing.
Yes. Yes.
So, Katie, how about, and I'm starting with things that seem to me to kind of be taking on new directions, which might be backwards, but I just to give people a taste of the different things that are out there. How about Nice Girls Finish Last?
Oh, Nice Girls Finish Last by Sparkle Hader. This is the second in a series. For those of you who need to read the series in order, then you want to start with What's a Girl Gotta Do? And the series character is Robin Hudson, and she's a bit brash and a little bit offbeat, and she is a third string reporter for the All News Network. This is, you'll learn a little bit, although it's dated information, about how a news network functions. It takes place in New York, and Robin is always investigating, like, this murdered gynecologist, and what's his relationship to Robin, and what is his relationship with other people in her workplace. These are fun. This is a snarky sense of humor. These are they've got feminist overtones, and they're a send up of these investigative journalist mysteries. Her favorite weapon is a hot glue gun. She has also used a pot of poison ivy in the last book to serve as a weapon for herself.
Seems like it would be effective.
It was very effective.
Long term, like for a week.
These are laugh out loud. This one was published in 1996, and I just remember loving Sparkle Hader's sense of humor. There weren't that many contemporary comic mysteries on the market at the time, and this one became a cult favorite among mystery series writers.
So Nice Girls Finish Last.
Nice Girls Finish Last by Sparkle Hader.
And I just want to say, so far, both of our protagonists are writers, and that seems like a natural for this genre because the writer is someone whose job is to observe and jot notes, or you know what I mean?
And notice.
Yep. And notice. Yeah.
Authors and journalists make really good amateur detectives. They seem to find themselves in those situations.
And that's the whole premise of the TV show Bored to Death, where a writer does take on a moonlighting role based on he thinks he can do it because he's read so many detective novels. That doesn't go well. Mark, tell me about Raymond Chandler. This is, so we're changing tone a bit here.
Well, so, you know, actually thinking of this in both. So Raymond Chandler is one of the giants of American detective writing. And he wrote The Big Sleep and Farewell, My Lovely, and books that people would probably know. He wrote an essay in 1950 for The Atlantic called The Simple Art of Murder. And in it, he basically claimed that Dashiell Hammett was
another well-known author in this genre.
Was the sort of premier detective writer. And what he argued is that what Hammett had done was take murder out of the parlor and drug it into the alley where it belonged.
where it belongs.
Well, yeah, I mean, where it belongs. And so it's not the Agatha Christie, like, oh, goodness, like, what was in the sherry? It's there's tough guys doing bad things, and more a reflection of, like, kind of how things actually were, rather than, you know, we're in a country house and, you know, somebody's fallen on a knife. And what he says is that these detectives have to walk these sort of mean streets, and they have to form their own code in a game where there's basically no honor. And so Chandler in The Big Sleep, he has the character of Philip Marlowe. And Marlowe is summoned by this fading patriarch, General Sternwood, to find his missing ex-son-in-law, who he thinks has been murdered, but he's not quite sure. The general has two daughters, Carmen and Vivian, who are both femme fatales. And between those two and a cast of pornographers, two-bit hustlers, gamblers, crooked cops, all these people sort of get in his way. And the thing that always sort of strikes me about this is that at one point, Marlowe is writing in first person. He says knights had no meaning in this game. Like, he tries to do a good job and he tries to do right, but that basically the world in which he's operating is so corrupt that someone with his attitudes has no place in this game.
So you are...
Which to me is fascinating.
This is sort of the basis for your Chandler and Hammett recommendations. What books would you recommend by Raymond Chandler and... I'm sorry, what is Hammett's first name?
Dashiell.
Dashiell Hammett.
Well, Red Harvest is sort of... That's the Continental op who then will become Sam Spade in a different book, in his later books. For Chandler, I would recommend The Big Sleep. I mean, it's kind of the first one. It also sort of secretly is the basis for the inspiration for The Big Lebowski.
Whoa.
And
you've got Dashiell, my attention.
For Dashiell Hammett, it would be Red Harvest.
Well, you still have a little time to get in on this conversation. Tell us about the kind of mysteries you like to read and maybe a book or two you'd recommend. You can call us at 816-235-2888 or use Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This is KCUR's Central Standard with the Bibliophiles. Back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today's show is a check-in with the Bibliophiles. They're helping us find our way around the mystery section of the bookstore or library. Katie Stover, what call numbers would those be?
Mystery F. And if you're going to go look in nonfiction, then you're looking for 81354 and the author's last name.
Katie Stover is obviously with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Mark Luce joins us from the Barstow School. And Jeffrey Angowdy is a freelance writer and book critic whose work appears in the Huffington Post, among other places. And Katie didn't know I was going to give her a pop quiz.
All right. We can play the Dewey Decimal game all day long if you want, Gina.
I kind of do. So, Katie... we were just talking about Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. You were recommending a Kansas City noir.
Oh, right. Yes. I brought Kansas City Noir with me because this is a lovely collection from all local authors, and our own Gina is in here. It's edited by Steve Paul, former bibliophile / book doctor. And there are so many wonderful, short, dark stories in this book. I marked two of my favorites. Linda Rodriguez, who wrote The Good Neighbor, and she sets it on South Troost. And this is a really creepy contemporary short story about what starts a crime and what drives someone to commit a crime inadvertently. And it's because this elderly gardener is, his garden is interrupted, his garden is threatened by a brand new neighbor who thinks that his indigenous plants and native plants are actually weeds. This neighbor reports this man's beautiful garden to the city. They issue a summons. He either needs to mow it down or pay a fine, or, and if they,
this
have
is very believable.
It seems so. And the elderly gardener makes a phone call that solves his problem temporarily and in the long run won't solve his problem.
You know, Katie, I just, if you were saying that your own Gina is in here, if you were referring to me, I did not contribute to the series. And I feel like I just need to let people know that so that nobody goes searching.
That's right.
I would be a terrible crime
Nadia,
and noir Nadia's writer.
The one that contributed.
Yes, my former colleague at The Pitch.
Right.
But yes.
Sorry, Nadia. Did just not get you confused.
Nadia
with Gina.
Has what it takes to be a noir writer, and I do not. Just putting that out there. So this is Kansas City Noir. It was edited by Steve Paul, right?
Edited by Steve Paul.
We have a lot of callers, and I want to go ahead and talk to a couple of them. Let's hear from Marilyn in Topeka. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Gina. I'd like to recommend Stuart Kaminsky. He passed away, unfortunately, in 2009, but I have read all of his two series. He has two excellent series. One stars Abe Lieberman, who's a family man and Columbo-type detective. He's Jewish, and he's in Chicago. His base is Chicago. And the other one that got me started in the first place is a Russian series. The detective's last name is Rosnikov, and he is fighting the system of corruption that is present in the time about which Kaminsky writes in Russia. And if anyone's heard of Donna Leon, she has a series featuring Guido Brunetti that takes place in Venice, and he's basically doing the same thing in that series, fighting corruption in Italian police systems.
Marilyn, thank you for those recommendations. I want to pick up with a theme in Marilyn's recommendations, which is that the political context of the time and political corruption can be a real basis for this genre.
Well, I mean, I think if you look at sort of the rise of sort of detective fiction in the U.S., it kind of coincides with the late 20s and Prohibition, where basically you have your average person, right, had becomes complicit in criminal conspiracy because they're going to have a beer. And to me, sort of just it opens up this whole thing where, like, there's this romance that's built around crime and criminals. And then also, like, since institutions have become corrupt, like the police are corrupt because they're allowing this to happen, it allows for an individual crime fighter to sort of come up and say, enough. Now, the thing is, that can take all kinds of different sort of ideological paths, whereas Hammett is pretty much more of a leftist and sort of a union fellow. Someone like Mickey Spillane, who's writing Mike Hammer, it's all about vengeance, right, and taking the law into your own hands. And so it's really kind of a fascinating sort of the way that ideology sort of seeps into these books.
You know, we have a staff recommendation. Kathleen Connigan-Gross tells us, and it's along these lines, The Lady Darby Mysteries by Anna Lee Huber. The first book is The Anatomist's Wife. Book 6 in the series came out earlier this year. It's set in the 1830s in Scotland, just a few years after the Burke and Hare trial, which is something I didn't know about, but it had something to do with body snatchers turned murderers. And she says Lady Darby is a portrait artist and a widow of a famous anatomist. And after his sudden death, it is discovered that she participated in his human dissections by illustrating the corpses for the anatomy book he was working on. Turns out she was doing this against her will. And she says it's a really interesting exploration of the role of women in that political context.
All for science.
Interesting. Fascinating.
I'm going to pass on that one.
I have not read those, but it's sounds interesting.
Let's talk to Marianne in Stillwell. Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
I wondered if anybody's familiar with the Cherry Ames books. They were on the same genre as Nancy Drew.
I think
Cherry Ames was a nurse.
Cherry Ames nurse. Yes, the Cherry Ames nurse series.
Go on, Jeff. Tell us about it.
Oh, sorry. That's all I remember is that she was a nurse. But along with the Bobbsey twins, the same vintage, the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, yeah, and Cherry Ames' nurse. Yes, I grew up reading those books.
Marianne, is there something you wanted to tell us about those books?
Well, no. My older sister wanted to be a nurse, and I presume that's how they got in the house. But I'm sure we had every book in the series, and I just loved them. I never hear anybody talk about them. So
well, you know, what I think is interesting here, we're also getting a note on Twitter from Bill, who is inspired to get his daughter a Nancy Drew book. She's 12. And this idea of where to get someone started, he's wanting to know if this is a good starting place or if you might recommend another foray into mystery in 2018.
You know, the thing about Nancy Drew is that these books were supposedly written by Carolyn Keene, that was a pseudonym, and there were two writers and maybe as many as six, and there are bunches of them, and I think there's a new iteration of Nancy Drew's, and I don't know.
Might be a
they're probably more contemporary
up-to-date.
And less dated.
They are.
Yeah.
They've been updated.
Well, so
and so I would say those for sure, both Nancy Drew and I don't know if the Hardy Boys have been updated, but then to be honest, I think that kids at the age of 12 would totally dig Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I don't think there's anything in those. There's a few things, you know, that he does that are probably not so good to show kids. But for the most part, he uses his mind and solves his crimes.
I would give an inquisitive 12-year-old The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie.
Why?
Because it will – then I would challenge the reader to come back and tell me when he or she figured out who done it.
Well, you know, okay, so we have also a recommendation along these lines from Steve Kraske, host of Up to Date, just a short time from now on KCUR. He says, as a boy, I read the entire Three Investigators series written mostly by a man named Robert Arthur. These were similar to the Hardy Boys books, but much better. The three boy investigators had their own office in an old trailer in the midst of a junkyard, and Steve thought it was the coolest thing ever. He says, you can only find the books online. I've looked endlessly at half-price books and other used bookstores and can't find them. For my 60th birthday, good friends bought him the first several books of the series as a gift.
Fantastic. I would like to interject. I brought in Blue Balliet's The Calder Game. This is a quartet of books about 12-year-old sleuths, and they solve art history mysteries. Missing Vermeer, The Wright Three, is Mysterious Happenings in the Robey House, the Frank Lloyd Wright. And this is about a missing Calder sculpture. And
it would be hard to lose one of those.
Yeah, well, I think
donated. This kid Calder, who's named after the sculptor, goes to England with his father to a conference. And there's a history-laden village, Woodstock, and they're very upset that somebody has donated and installed a brand-new modern Alexander Calder sculpture, and they do not appreciate it. So pretty soon the boy goes missing and the sculpture goes missing. And two of the sleuth friends come over with their elderly neighbor, Mrs. Sharp, and they solve all the crimes.
That sounds fun.
She has an art history – Blue Balliet has an art history degree from Brown.
It does sound fun. I'm going to take one last call real quick. Andrew in Prairie Village, we have very little time, but I want to hear what you have to say.
Sure, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to recommend the Nero Wolfe series by Rex Stout, who actually briefly attended KU back around the early 1900s. And it's a wonderful series. There's about 70 in total, and it's just a wonderful series, mainly because of the interactions between the protagonist, Nero Wolfe, and his sidekick, Archie Goodwin. It's just a wonderful relationship, and it's just a really enjoyable series set in New York in the 1930s and 40s.
Well, so does anyone want to jump in on this?
I gave you a card. One of the reporters here hardly recommends that.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So, Michelle Tyrene Johnson recommends Rex Stout's Nero Wife as well. So before we go, I also am getting some staff recommendations from Cody Newell, who is recommending Umberto Eco, which he calls Umberto Eco Brie to Dan Brown's Cheese Whiz.
He's right.
Can you elaborate on that? Anyone?
Umberto Eco is difficult to read. Dan Brown is not. Umberto Eco uses nice language. Dan Brown does not.
Umberto Eco wants a little more participation from his readers in his books. He wants you to work a little harder to solve the puzzle.
He's not looking at the movie deal.
I would say that Dan Brown has sold a few more books than Umberto Eco.
Name of the Rose is the one that Cody's probably loving.
Yeah, Name of the Rose and Foucault's Pendium, and mentioned Foucault's Foucault Pendulum, and yes. You know they're not looking for the movie deal. Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, Katie Stover, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
They are the Bibliophiles. They bring us book recommendations seasonally, so we'll be talking again when it's cold outside. You can get the audio from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And that's a wrap. Tomorrow, our series on first-time voters returns with a guide on how to plan for your day at the polls, and that's advice we can use no matter how many times we have voted, plus a chat with Susan Orlean about her new book. Don't miss it. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Sophia Gillespie's our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.